This week, it's the battle of the information wars. As the world feels the knock-on effects of Russia's war in Ukraine, how much of the battle is playing out online, on social media, and in the information you access? There are fears the Kremlin is targeting Africans with a disinformation campaign designed to gain influence across the continent. We'll take you inside Russian disinformation and learn why experts say the Kremlin is waging a hybrid war.
Low-cost, high-influence tools such as the deployment of mercenaries, election interference, armed for resources deals, and disinformation campaigns are invariably opaque and destabilizing.
Plus, what does it take for an immigrant to become a millionaire in the United States? We'll meet the Africans who have found ways to make their American dreams come true. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. When Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited four African countries recently, he harkened back to Soviet-era support for Africa's fight for liberation. He sought to calm fears about the global food crisis and inflation, blaming Western sanctions and not Russia's war in Ukraine. And you might argue the optics were powerful. Old friends reaffirming long-standing ties. Is it all part of the Kremlin's global battle to win support and influence, even as a war that Russia started takes an economic toll on people across the African continent? Elizabeth Chernoff narrates this report from VOA News' bureau in Moscow.
On Ukraine overshadowed a trip by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to Egypt, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the Republic of Congo last month. On his tour, Lavrov sought to play up the view that Russia's aspirations are in line with Africa's.
We are living through a very important historical period, a period where we will all be deciding what kind of universe we are going to have and to live for our children and grandchildren.
Russia is now boosting relations with Africa that were abandoned after the Soviet collapse in the 1990s. Observers say the image of a superpower that countered Western imperialism is still present today.
After the revolution of 1917, the Soviet Union was pursuing an active ideological struggle under freedom to the colonial peoples slogan. And in the African mind, an image of Russia is primarily an image of the country that was actively standing against colonial domination.
Moscow has been cut off from the West after its attack on Ukraine. But doors are still open for Russia in Asia and Africa, whose leaders have hesitated to back international sanctions. The Kremlin, analysts say, will not miss this opportunity.
Very many African nations have not joined the sanctions pressure imposed on Russia that had been initiated by the West. They prefer to stay aside in this geopolitical controversy of Moscow and the Western capitals.
The war in Ukraine and the blockade of Ukrainian grain shipments has set off alarms in many African countries, which depend on those exports and are now facing shortages or even famine. Moscow sees a chance to win the cooperation of these countries.
Trade, investments, energy, public health care, food security, no doubt, because so much is linked to the security situation in Ukraine. The African states suffer due to the restrictions on grain deliveries.
With Lavrov's visit, Moscow sought to reassure African nations that it would continue to supply grain and work to renew its presence in a region where it had been long forgotten. For VOA's Moscow Bureau, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Well, Kremlin disinformation appears to be a key part of what many are calling a hybrid war. And experts say even before Russia invaded Ukraine, the groundwork for it began online.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine, the groundwork had already begun online. Russian disinformation is a key part of what many are calling a hybrid war.
You've got the conventional weapons, the tanks, the drones, the missiles, but you've also then got this disinformation war that has started months before the actual physical invasion began. We found a coordinated network of Twitter accounts that are spreading pro-Russian disinformation and propaganda about Ukraine. And we found that the activity of these accounts has surged.
On February 21st, Russian President Vladimir Putin recognized as independent the so-called People's Republics of Luhansk and Donetsk.
Many of the key points that President Putin made were directly using the same terminology and the same narratives, almost word for word, as what these accounts in this coordinated network had been saying for months.
A few days before, videos like this one purporting to show an attempt by Ukrainian and Polish mercenaries to blow up chlorine tanks in Donetsk were published as a pretext for Russia's invasion. But the open source intelligence community quickly debunked it.
It was edited in Adobe, actually, and then some people, Twitter users, also found a video that was published on YouTube in 2010. And then sound from this YouTube video was used, actually, while composing the video clip that Donetsk authorities published. And also, metadata of this video showed that basically the path of the files which were used while composing the video, and then there was a file name dating back to 2021. And it was really obvious that the video was not from February 18, and B, video was not authentic.
Experts say the volume of pro-Kremlin disinformation will only intensify as the war plays out.
Nowadays, Kremlin's main task is to just cover up Russian casualties in Ukraine, and not just Russian casualties, but also the fact that Russia is attacking civilian targets in Ukraine.
But one effective countermeasure appears to be hearing directly from local Ukrainians themselves, including the president.
Here you have a leader of a country where Russia is attacking and actually using the same video message, video apps and digital platforms to communicate with not just his population, but with the world, and to actually debunk some of the disinformation narratives.
Russia may have an established network of human and artificial intelligence actors to spread disinformation, but in Ukraine, new voices are emerging to set the record straight, speaking their truths and rallying the world around them.
So is Russia waging an information war? What does it look like, and how is it playing out across the African continent? And joining me now to discuss this is Salem Solomon. She's a lead editor in VOA's News Center and joins us from Cape May, New Jersey, here in the United States. And also with us is Mary Blankenship. She's a policy researcher at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Ladies, it is great to have you both with me. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Mary, I have read that you say the term fake news has now become meaningless. And you've analyzed some 70 million tweets about the war in Ukraine. And you say you have found an abundance of information pollution. Please tell us what you mean by that.
Thank you for having me. Well, information pollution is a term I use to replace fake news. It is, as it's a more, a less biased, politicized, and a broader term that was originally coined by the European Council. And it used to describe a variety of online incorrect information, like disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, and propaganda, which in this case has been very prevalent.
Salem, you reported on this extensively. The info wars, what do they look like on the African continent? Who are the characters at play, and how does Russia figure into that?
Thank you, Sadie. You know, there are several players on the African continent with different intentions. You know, we have the Western media, like the likes of the Voice of America, the BBC, with the intent to seek the truth. Just, you know, export our First Amendment, for example, here in the U.S., you know, tried and true journalism. But what Russia is doing is very interesting. And we have also other players like China, you know, Iranian-funded TV stations like Press TV. We have Qatar-funded media outlets like Al Jazeera. So many players, basically. It's very crowded. But what makes Russia's, what Russia's doing to control the narrative in Africa, what makes it very unique is because for years and years, Russia has been strategically playing the information game. The term disinformation is not like misinformation because it's fabricating something that to feed off of something that you're planning to. And so it's a handful of African countries, they've been involved. They've been investing money, resources, things like radio stations to broadcast Kremlin-supported messages. They've been publishing web pages on local languages so that they can reach their audience. They've cultivated relationship and paid local reporters who sometimes might need the income to amplify their messages, sometimes false messages. And so principal countries I can think of are the Central African Republic, Madagascar, Libya, Sudan. It goes on and on. But it's so important to understand the distinction and the difference. And Mary said very eloquently that fake news is not a term that we need to use as journalists as well, because it really perpetuates what it's trying to do to news, is discredit our line of work, seeking truth. And so that's what Russia is involved in. And it's very problematic to see it in several countries. We can go into examples later on.
Mary, it was the late South African liberation hero Nelson Mandela who once said one of the mistakes which some political analysts make is to think that their enemies should be our enemies, and that, this is me paraphrasing what he said, that our, meaning by the Africans, attitude towards any country is determined by the attitude of that country to our struggle. And of course, here he was talking about the likes of Yasser Arafat, Muammar Gaddafi, Fidel Castro, who, these are figures who Africans see as having supported the continent's struggle for liberation. And that is also an in for the former Soviet Union. A lot of these relationships are about nostalgia, and African leaders see themselves as having, you know, a different kind of relationship with Russia than the West might have. So how do you tell people now that Russia is lying to them and is using them and sowing disinformation to, for its own ends?
You bring up so many excellent points. First, with the nostalgia that especially Russia has felt. In Russia nowadays, the Soviet Union and World War II is celebrated almost as a religion, especially with events like Victory Day, almost like a religious holiday. But you bring up the other interesting point where a lot of the disinformation campaigns and the propaganda that is especially focused on Africa is not really these outrageous claims like in other parts of the region. In the case of Africa, much of the propaganda is geared towards exacerbating the existing grievances that African nations have towards the West and especially towards Europe, with previous and past conflicts, and then also Europe's history of colonialization within the continent. So these are very successful in getting various Africans online to at least appear as if they're siding with Russia. But that's one of the items that makes it so difficult to counter these kinds of disinformation, because it is able to thread itself so well within the larger grievances that various African nations have.
Salim, I want to play a snippet here from an interview that you did with Joseph Siegel from the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Let's take a listen.
What's distinctive about Russia's engagements in Africa are the asymmetric methods that it's using to pursue these strategic objectives. Low-cost, high-influence tools such as the deployment of mercenaries, election interference, arms for resources deals, and disinformation campaigns are invariably opaque and destabilizing. These tools are typically employed as part of a package in support of vulnerable political leaders, often authoritarian regimes, lacking legitimacy, and politically isolated, who then are indebted to Moscow. The result is compromised African sovereignty.
Salim, what is Russia's goal here? Based on what he said there, I mean, I always wonder, is it just to be believed and supported and have that support among African countries? I mean, what is the end game and what is in it for Russia to spread a disinformation campaign?
That's a very good question. Dr. Siegel, as you saw here, he was talking at the House hearing in front of Congress, talking about the, in general, what Russia has determined, like these sort of asymmetric efforts. They've decided that it gives them a strategic advantage. And what that means is that they realize they cannot compete with the likes of China, for instance, who's really poured in a lot of money in terms of development or investment or trade. And they cannot compete with countries like the U.S. in terms of offering traditional aid or military cooperation, or even, you know, in terms of the media seeking out the truth, basically exporting the First Amendment, as I said earlier. So because they cannot compete, information efforts help Russia to get a bigger bang for their buck. And they know that with a relatively small investment, you know, it really takes a few low-paid bloggers or starting a website or, you know, operating a troll farm. And we've seen it in Ghana, for instance, just to spread falsehoods or made-up stories to make a big impact because of the nature of, you know, how we consume media, how we consume information on social media and very easily accessible platforms. And we have a population that sometimes is not really media literate, so they don't know how, where the information is coming from. But more widely, Russia has always had a hybrid strategy to influence countries' targets. And this includes, you know, the information war that we're talking about. And what that means is that, you know, not sometimes, but most of the time, making up stories and efforts to interfere in elections. So they're against democratic processes. And so, you know, or military efforts to enable some sort of security in African countries. So they send mercenaries, which are private companies that are linked with the Kremlin, but without the accountability, although they use, you know, Russian passports and Russian resources to get involved in these countries. And so it really helps their diplomatic efforts and create some friendly countries, as you said, because there's nostalgia during the Soviet era. And so they try to play on that. And so this is just one prong and a multi-pronged effort. And in places like the Central African Republic, you will see that Russia has deployed mercenaries because it's funding radio stations and websites, creating a movie just to win the hearts and minds of people, and involved in supporting, you know, preferred candidates when there are elections, seeking to help Central African Republic diplomatically, but also, you know, to rid itself, Russia itself, of sanctions. And so this is a part of a large strategy that Russia has.
And Mary, how successful is the strategy?
That's what I really wanted to get into. Online, it works very well with other forms of asymmetrical warfare that was just mentioned. Trying to hone in, not just to justify the war, but I think also normalize this war as a new international order, and then reframe the conflict as sort of this East-West struggle, and Russia being a counterbalance to Western nations and Western influence, especially in Africa. That's why you see one of the most prevalent types of Russian narratives be about anti-European Union, anti-NATO, NATO, and very specifically honing in into past conflicts that NATO was involved in or that the U.S. was involved in. Whether it's successful, that's a much bigger and more complicated question to answer. There's huge presence of online Russian narratives, also about what I call whataboutism. So shifting the discussion to other topics, and topics in this case related to different issues within the continent, or claiming hypocrisy, or just not being able to take the criticism for the war. And so on the scale, it's on the scale of hundreds of thousands of tweets. Now, whether that translates into meaningful change within the context of this war is a more difficult question to answer. However, what it does do is fog the discussion surrounding Ukraine, and it can delay decision or altogether stop decision. And in a case like this, in a situation that is so volatile and so many lives depend on it, that can have dangerous consequences.
Salem, we heard that last week. We heard news that the Kremlin-backed RT news channel is reportedly planning to set up a hub in South Africa. And I say this again against this backdrop of people in African countries, and especially in South Africa, where I am from, don't necessarily feel the same way about Russia as people might in Western countries or in the United States. So I don't know how easy or difficult it is going to be for an outlet like RT to get an audience, to have reporters, credible reporters working for them. But they'll be occupying the same space like Voice of America does on television across African countries, like outlets like France 24, Al Jazeera, BBC, etc. They're going to be in that same space now. Salem, I just want to play what Fonte Akum said to you. He's from the Institute of Security Studies. He spoke to you recently about this. Let's hear what he says.
News outlets like Sputnik and Russia Today, it's state-owned media house which has a global reach. Russia Today, for example, covers issues neglected by mainstream global media and which resonate with some communities across the continent. I'll take a case in point. In 2018, Russia Today broadcast a Russian-sponsored national beauty contest in the Central African Republic, the first in a very long time, and it enabled Russia to deploy its soft power at very minimal cost, approximately $15,000. And state-backed media ventures are also used to publicize the missteps of the United States and other Western powers operating in Africa in a bid to give Russia an outsized level of influence and appeal across the continent at relatively little diplomatic or financial cost.
Well, Salem, you know, there's a saying about when it talks about things like, when you talk about things like morality and truth, whose morality are we talking about? Whose truth are we talking about here? And when I listen to Fonte there, this could be about showing what the United States is doing wrong, just as the United States might show the missteps of Russia. What are people to believe, and how will RT, perhaps taking up greater space now in African media, how is that going to change the game or affect the landscape?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But what was discussed there is about earlier, as I mentioned, you know, Russia getting a bigger bang for its buck. We're talking about not truth in terms of disinformation. We are talking about the deliberate effort of making up stories to misinform in order to feed into a bigger strategy that we're talking about. I'll give you an example. In Mali, for instance, you know, Russian mercenaries were accused, and this is because of a drone footage that was leaked later on that exposed. But because Russia's effort is to undermine the West or any other European countries that are against its recent war invasion of Ukraine, they basically staged a mass grave near a military base that is close to where the French used to be based, so that they can create this made-up story. And so we're not talking about, a battle for truth here. We're talking about how do you, start over a conversation when things aren't made up. So it's very difficult when you see the landscape. So the South Africa case is very interesting because of the Russia invasion of Ukraine. The landscape has changed for Russia, and things have highly more important now that they're looking for friends on the continent. And sometimes, you know, experts are asking, are they swaying the hearts and minds of the countries that they're investing or targeting? You know, because it's so difficult to say. And one thing that was interesting was the UN vote in March to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Only 28 out of 54 African countries voted to support the resolution to condemn Russia's invasion, if you remember. And 17 countries abstained from the vote. And one country, Eritrea, with full disclosure, which happens to be my home country, voted against the resolution. And what does that say? You know, the rest of the world, 81% of the countries voted to condemn Russia, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so it is clear that African countries, at least the leadership and that nostalgia that you talked about, are less ready to break ties with Russia over Ukraine than the rest of the world. That's what that shows us. Just to measure based on actions. And so, you know, many African countries are more sympathetic to Russia than the rest of the world. There's, as you said, historical reasons for this. Many African leaders have either studied in Russia or have had an ideological, you know, an ideological link that is sympathetic to colonialism, to communism. In Russia, place that colonialism backdrop to use it for its advantage. And so there are so many reasons why they may seek partnership with Russia. And African leaders, particularly autocrats, because that's what Russia enables, they've been made international pariahs because of the support and the funding and the resources that they exchange with Russia. And Russia presents itself as a partner, and you've seen Sergei Lavrov basically going around blaming the West while Russia is, you know, shelling Ukraine and preventing grain from, you know, creating a blockade from grain, preventing grain from leaving, you know, basically creating a food shortage in the world. So he's out making this elaborate trip to convince Africa leaders and Africans who are listening, because Russia comes without any precondition when they're forming relationship with these African countries, like human rights, because they probably don't want that kind of lens, put on their leadership in their home country, and or democracy itself, you know, the transparency, being held to account, and the media is part of that bigger effort to seek the truth and to hold your powerful accountable, and that is not the part of participation that Russia has shown in action to be part of in the world. So this is the most important factor that we talk about when African countries don't want to pick sides between Russia and China and the U.S. and Europe. Yes, they want to diversify their partnership, but what are they, giving up in the process of that is what we're discussing here. Because, you know, countries remember the Cold War era where they found themselves in many, many cases to be part of a proxy war between the U.S. and the USSR, and they don't want to find themselves in that position. So that could be one other reason why they're making these choices, and they don't want to repeat that. So they'll be very hesitant, and we've seen it with, as I gave an example of the U.N., hesitant to condemn Russia outright for fear that they might be taking sides or picking sides again. And so this is the landscape that we're talking about in terms of, you know, having an impact. And we've seen different examples. We can talk about, you know, pro-Russian street demonstrations in West Africa that looks like grassroots movement, but definitely pro-Kremlin propaganda and also the follow-up of the mercenary groups coming in. And in all these countries where you see Russian involvement, there is an incessant either disinformation or falsehoods that spread, just like what I mentioned in Mali, where they staged a mass grave before the next stage of involvement for, you know, extracting resources. You'll see this involvement in places where there are mineral resources, You know, and so many war crimes being, you know, inflicted on civilians. And we've heard stories of the Wagner Group being involved in killing of civilians, pillaging of villages and rapes. And we've done so many stories about those executions. I'm talking about, you know, having a link without zero accountability. And so this is the kind of information war or whatever you might call it we're grappling with and trying to understand it so we can counter it with truth.
Well, I want to bring Mary in here quickly. Based on what Salim has said, I mean, these are powerful relationships we're talking about. I always think when you say leaders who have studied in a particular country, we know those ties, many of the ties we see in diplomacy circles today between the United States, for instance, and some African countries go back to leaders' university days and where they built those connections. And we talk about the nostalgia and the support for the struggle for liberation. These are very important, very strong ties that Russia has built in and across Africa. You are from Ukraine, full disclosure on your side here too. You are from Ukraine and you know a little something about how Russia operates. What would be your advice to those listening on the African continent when dealing with Russia in this way? What to look out for and how all of this ends?
Mm-hmm. Well, at least online, something that surprised me was a lot of the disinformation and misinformation also originated not from accounts that don't necessarily look like they are Russian-funded or Russian-backed, but from accounts of journalists within Africa or people claiming they're journalists, and also activist accounts typically associated with different campaigns within Africa, like the Tigray region in Ethiopia, that have since the start of the war shifted a lot of their tweets to perpetuating different Russian claims and narratives. For me, I thought that's really interesting, and for the average African user going on social media, that might not be an obvious thing that they may notice, and so they can buy into those narratives and continuing the spread of disinformation and misinformation as well. I would suggest for users online, when they see different information pollution, to not repost it, not re-like it, if they notice they're having an emotional reaction to it. Disinformation has the greatest chance of spreading when it perpetuates emotions of anger and fear, especially towards another group. And so in this case, with how Russia is framing their different campaigns, that group would be the West, Europe, the U.S. Another aspect is, and because we are dealing with a war where the events are changing at a rapid pace, it's important to take a step back and make sure when you are interacting with something that you see online that it is actually verified. So that takes a bit of self-control. And if you do see something that you think is disinformation, don't engage with it. Do not like it. Do not repost it, even if you are disagreeing with it, because at the end of the day, the algorithm cannot tell whether you're agreeing with a piece of information or not. It is seeing that people are interacting with it, and it will continue its propagation online.
Well, Mary Blankenship and Salim Solomon, what a fascinating conversation indeed. Thank you so very much for joining me. I do appreciate your perspectives and I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, now, another big story we're following here on Straight Talk Africa is the Kenyan presidential election, now just 6 days away on August 9th. And the race is extremely tight. VOA Africa television managing editor Vincent McCorry is in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, and has this report for us.
The Kenyan elections are taking place in about 1 week from now. Now, I've been on the streets of Nairobi talking to potential voters about what is important to them. And, of course, we have met young people, older people, male and female. Here, listen to what they had to say about the upcoming elections.
I'm not interested in these elections. First, kuna advantages na disadvantages. Let me start with the advantages. In Kenya, you find that people say the same thing. If you elect me, I'll do this and this for you. But you only see that after the 5 years are ending. Like now, this is the time you see people building the highways, the everything. But the disadvantage is they only do it that in the last year in order to convince you that they'll do their work or whatever. So I think it's useless for me. Just this, they do the same thing each and every time. We've not seen anything else.
Same round, if you look at the scenario, we only have at least two human beings, contenders. The former, the opposition leader, the former prime minister, and the current David. See that? The current David, he has nothing special. It's nothing new to offer. Why? He's been there for the last 10 years. What is it that is now going to be given to become a president so that he can serve Kenyans? We are not seeing anything like that. We really want the change. For this old man, he's somebody who has been championing for our rights, left and right. And he has been in opposition for such a long time. He has also suffered as a result of trying to fight for Kenyans. Now we work to reward him.
I don't feel like we are benefiting from this election. Either way, we vote or we don't, we are not represented in any way. Even when you hear the news, you hear them talking, you hear the politicians, there's nothing much that is helping us. It's mostly propaganda. So I don't think I'll be participating.
You see, the leaders we have in Kenya, they don't accept the outcome of the election. Now, they start using youths and some niggas here fighting and throwing stones. Yeah, that's the cause of violence. It's caused by leaders, you see? Yeah. You see, some youths are learned but don't have opportunities to have work, you see? Now youths are tired of every after 5 years going to elect someone who's not focused on the youths. Yeah.
Well, those are the thoughts of the potential voters on the streets of Nairobi in the countdown to these elections. Candidates are all over the country trying to converse for last-minute votes. And as we know, in Kenya, elections are tension-filled. So we'll be on the streets of this country, on the streets of Nairobi, to let you know what's going on and to talk to as many people as we can for the next 14 days or so. Vincent Macquarie, VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Well, thank you for that great report, Vincent. And Vincent, it will be on the scene for us, and we will go to him next week on that edition of Straight Talk Africa as Kenyan voters go to the polls on August 9th to choose a successor to President Uhuru Kenyatta. Still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, how these African-born immigrants became millionaires in America. We'll hear their story and speak to the VOA producer behind the scenes. That's next. Stay with us.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Empowerment and humanity towards a better world.
Economic and social progress of every society.
Facts and information from key players rather than spectators in politics, business, science and technology.
City, rural, educated or underprivileged. We care and we listen to what matters to you.
Your voices are our voices.
And you're back with Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. The American dream has ignited the imagination of many worldwide. For some, it represents freedom. For others, opportunity. And the United States has long been seen as a prime destination for generations of immigrants. Some come here legally and some don't, all in the hopes of achieving that dream. And with me is the creator of a new VOA documentary, African Millionaires in America. Arzuma Compaore is the executive producer for television for the French to Africa News Service here at The Voice of America, and he joins me now. Arzuma, first of all, before we see anything, I must tell you, I watched parts of this, and I will still watch the whole thing, but I want to say great job here, and I want to talk to you a little bit about your thinking behind this, how you found these characters. But first, why did you decide to highlight millionaires? Because not all of us come here and become millionaires. Why did you choose that particular group?
Thanks, Heidi. So it's a good question, because actually I remember very vividly about, you know, many years ago when I first landed in America, somebody told me USA stands for You Start Again. So right there I knew, well, okay, You Start Again. I was already being set to understand I have to pay my dues. I have to pave the way and really work hard to get to where I want to go. So that always stayed with me. And then lately, I actually wrote an article by the Pew Center, Research Center, who was saying that the African immigrant household in America has a median income of $60,000 a year. That's from a study in 2019. Compared to 55 for, you know, the rest of America, which really got me thinking, okay, well, I mean, you know, they're not doing that bad. So I really, you know, started to investigate right there. And I wanted to know, okay, if that's the median, you know, who is really making it? And where are they? Where aren't we seeing them? Where is mainstream media not talking about them? And I just realized, well, maybe I can just grab my camera and do something about it. So everything really started there. Looking for those Warren Buffett's Africans, from Africa, living in America.
This is very fascinating, and I'm sure you've had some very interesting reactions so far to this piece, because it's like you said, it does show a segment of society that we don't see in our daily life and very, very often. Obviously, I know why I don't, because I don't move in the same circles as millionaires. I don't know about you, but, you know, this is not something we see every day. And what we see and imagine about a group of people is very important, and it is based on who and what you see. What has the reaction been so far on social media and from other quarters to this documentary?
It's been very overwhelming, to be honest, because I was not expecting so many positive feedback, and also the thirst and the hunger. People just needed this story, you know. If you haven't done it yet, I really, really urge you, encourage you to go finish watching the movie and take, you know, 5 seconds or minutes to just read some of the comments that you're going to find on, you know, on the our social media pages, on YouTube, for example. It's very, you know, revealing to what people want and why America is still the dream destination for so many people.
And we're going to play a clip from your documentary. You can obviously keep plugging it throughout our conversation. But this one features Dr. Akin Kolade. Now, he's a psychiatrist, and he's originally from Nigeria. I watched his story. This was probably one of my favorites. Why did you choose to tell his story?
Well, you know, it's like in any adventure that you decide. Like, I actually laid out a number, maybe 6 candidates. And he was one of the strongest, you know, person that the story and what they were portraying was telling me that, okay, I want to talk about it. But most importantly, I wanted to showcase and put a light on the level of education that most African achieve when they come to America. I'm not going to give it away. You have to watch the documentary. But because of the thirst and the need to really prove to himself that he deserves better, he came back to America, did the You Start Again thing, because as a doctor, he had to redo a lot of the licensing and all that. And, you know, went on to accumulate, you know, subspecialties after subspecialties after subspecialties, just to show you that, okay, he can do it, anybody else can do it.
Okay, so he leads a pretty fabulous life. Without any further ado, here is the story of Dr. Akin Kolade.
According to a 2019 study by the Pew Research Center, 1 in 10 black people living in the U.S. are immigrants. 40% of all African immigrants aged 25 and older have at least a bachelor's degree or higher.
Hi, this is Dr. Kolade. How are you doing?
Dr. Akindele Kolade is a certified psychiatrist, principal investigator at the Kolade Research Institute, and president and CEO of Cal Psychiatrist Services. He is also a successful serial entrepreneur and philanthropist.
I'm originally from Nigeria, but now I'm practicing in the United States. A psychiatrist, first and foremost, and then subspecialized in child psychiatry and adolescent psychiatry, and also in addiction medicine. So I'm triple boarded. And I also do research, clinical research for upcoming medications to treat mental health. I'm consulting for 5 hospitals across America in different states. So we virtually see these patients in different locations and environments, be it in the hospitals or in the clinics or sometimes in their homes. And virtually, because in psychiatry you don't have to touch a patient, but with today's technology you could basically see everything and know everything, just look at the computers and prescribe medication or do counseling or do therapy, whatever you need to do to make them move forward.
And that the medication is not working.
Does she use melatonin also? In my practice, I've witnessed an increase and an uptick in people looking for mental health compared to before the pandemic. We've seen an increase of over 30%. Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Good. So what are we doing today?
You want to see if I can possibly get a refill?
Okay. Any side effects?
No.
I see a lot of private patients. I see a lot of athletes. And I see a lot of patients through insurance companies. I see some pro bono patients that I do for free. Everybody comes in differently. And that's what we do, whatever it takes to move them forward from this condition to this condition in a good way. Okay, so that's how we go. That's how we roll.
9 p.m., we meet Dr. Akin in a completely different setting. Tonight, he invites us to his brand new luxury lounge in Las Vegas.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Welcome, sir.
Everything good tonight?
Everything's wonderful, sir.
Okay, let's go party. Somebody asked me this. How come a doctor is opening a restaurant? It's service. It's service for the people in many varieties, be it in medicine, be it in the clinic, or be in the restaurant where you eat good food, or where you dance, or where you sing, or where you enjoy comedy. All that brings about wellness and health in all of us.
To Raymond. To Raymond.
I've never been an A student. I didn't tell anybody I was an A student, but I never gave up. I fall, I wake up and do it again. I fall, wake up and do it again. Which is different from repeating the same mistake over and over and over. But I learn from my mistake. When I fall, I learn why I did fall. I know there's more educated Africans in this country than in any other part of the universe. Please tell your story. Let's tell people what we do so that nobody would think that we are from a whole country, because we ain't from a whole country. We have brains. It is time for us to just stop being timid and let the little brown boys and girls emulate you and copy you and be like you and become you and do better. And that's what I'm going to teach my children, and that's why I'm doing this. I just want to start something.
And I know this one made me a little emotional there towards the end as well, because when you're an immigrant, the power of what you see, wasn't it when Kamala Harris became the vice president, there was a lot of the saying going around that if you can see it, you can be it. And it also really defies the stereotype there exists about immigrants, that immigrants come to a particular country, and this is not just in the United States, I mean, the sort of anti-immigrant sentiment is everywhere in the world, this idea that immigrants only come to take and not really focusing on what they contribute, right? And you did that so well here. I want you to give us a preview of the story of our next subject, who's Douglas Eze. He's a wealth strategist, correct?
Absolutely. And it's a good contrast with, you know, Akindele, who went to, you know, have all these diplomas and highly, you know, specialized doctor. Douglas Eze calls himself, he has a PhD. A PhD is just like, you know, a street, you know, public, you know, high school diploma.
The from school the street. Of hard knocks.
Exactly. So he is, you know, he came here with no, you know, college degree at all, only high school. And he decided that he was going to make it, actually, at age 25, he decided he wanted to be a millionaire. So coming to America, he came with a very specific idea. Anything I can get in my hand, I'm going to get so good at this that I'm going to make it. So this is how he was able to actually, you know, go from sleeping in his car when he first started, when he first got here, to now, you know, having, you know, the success that he has. But again, you know, it's not just about the material goods that he accumulates. When you look at the documentary and you start learning about who they are, you feel emotional because you see the human side that they have. He gave a part of himself in America. I'm not going to say more. You have to watch it.
And they should all hire you to be their spokesperson. But this stuff really is. This is good stuff, and I love it. Let's watch the story now of Douglas Eze.
It is the world's most dominant economic power with an iconic concept that has made it the number one destination for most immigrants, the American dream. Douglas Eze is one of the 2 million Africans who decided to make it their new country and who was able to transform his life. Beyond the restless accumulation of material goods, the self-described wealth strategist and award-winning insurance agent is now climbing into the wealthiest 1% club of society.
I wanted to learn more about wealthy families. How do they keep wealth in the family from one generation to the next? So I actually wrote a book called Creating Generational Wealth.
An immigrant from Nigeria, he is now a top-of-the-table member of the Million Dollar Roundtable, an exclusive club for the top insurance people in the world.
Well, wealth is basically, you know, that money that you're going to leave for your children's children. You know, because there's one thing, getting rich is one thing, and being wealthy is making sure that your family, your generation, your name stays in the family legacy forever.
At conferences like this one, Douglas often shares his personal story of making it in America.
Been in the financial service industry for over 20 years, an entrepreneur on a technology company and also real estate.
The next award goes to Douglas Eze.
Well, thank you so much, everyone.
When he is not invited to talk or receive an award, he uses the opportunity to expand his network, a word that he has quickly come to associate with his net worth.
The first time I made $1 million, I felt good. But then I realized, where's the money? It was all in stuff. And then I had to say to myself, man, you know, if you keep spending the money, you're not going to have the money. And Warren Buffett, he has two favorite quotes. The first one is, never lose your money. His second quote is, don't forget rule number one, never lose your money. You know, so I had to change my mindset and start teaching myself how to make sure that I keep every dollar that I spend, I pay back with simple interest and compounding interest. A lot of people miss that part. It's called self-financing. So what then we try to teach is show people, even if you make $50,000 a year, $30,000 a year, I show them how much that money is valued 20, 30 years from today with an increase. And I say, you know what? Guess who else knows the value of your money? The federal government, the banks, the media.
With 8 businesses under his belt, Douglas's philosophy is simple. Hard work pays off. And when it comes to it, the cash value king, as he calls himself, uses his money to enjoy life and discover new hobbies.
Okay, cool. Just keep the noise going.
Yeah.
Damn. It's beautiful. So, don't mess with me, man. All the way down is gonna be marble. That's an elevator.
Hard work pays off, man. 1993, I was still in Canada, man, when this house was built. I was like 27 years old. And now it's mine.
Not bad for a guy from West Africa with no college degree living the American dream.
So, Azuma, this one's making me strategize around my own lack of wealth here, and trying to figure out how I can become a cash value queen.
I like that.
But, you know, speaking of women, you also do the story of Adisa Barry. She's from Burkina Faso, which is where you're from, too. A woman of color who is an immigrant and working in a very competitive, male-dominated industry. Tell us a little bit about her, too, please.
Oh, yeah. She is definitely my, favorite, I want to say, because it doesn't take long. Just look at her. You look at her demeanor, her face, her integrity. Everything exudes out of her is really telling you, you know, about perseverance and abnegation. She, as a single mom in America, raising three kids, and now running this kind of empire. You know, it's quite of an achievement. I think it's very inspiring. And if I can say, like, most than anything else, like, when people read the word millionaire, it's really a wordplay, you know, maybe suggesting that, you know, here it's not just about material goods. It goes a lot beyond.
Yeah, and it's about, you know, the lifestyle that you build for yourself. So I'm so grateful that you did not interview any South Africans, because people would then say, how come they made it to millionaire status and I didn't? But Azuma, this is great. Did you find that any of your folks, just very briefly, had in common certain characteristics?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the giving back is really something that was very seizing to me. Like, I really felt like for them, to be where they are right now, they had to give something, you know, all of them, you know, and individually they have to give a big sacrifice in order to make it to where they are. But ultimately, it's something that was rewarding enough for them, so that now they're very happy to talk about it.
Well, Azuma, thank you so much. This was great work. Congratulations
on
this documentary.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Well, be sure to watch the entire documentary, African Millionaires in America. You can go to our YouTube channel, voaafrica.com, and search under VOA Africa Millionaires. And don't forget to leave a comment. Of course, we would like to hear what you think about this documentary. Thank you so much for watching our show this week. Thanks to all my guests. Thanks to all our affiliates airing the show across the African continent, and thank you to you for joining us on television, radio, and online. Thank you so much for watching, and thank you for listening. Until next time, I'll see you. Goodbye.